Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's decision to investigate community bonds for affordable housing initiatives.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
At their April 15th meeting, Council unanimously voted to explore creative social investment options to tackle the housing and homelessness crisis. According to data from the City of Kingston, as of January 2025, 503 individuals are experiencing homelessness in the Kingston community and more are precariously housed. The city currently has a goal of creating 480 affordable housing and supportive housing units by the end of 2026. With an eye towards sustainable development and greater civic engagement, the city is exploring the use of community bonds as a tool to fund affordable housing initiatives. The motion states it is looking to encourage residents and local organizations to invest directly in community projects, while ensuring that the financial benefits, such as interest payments, remain within the community. The city's chief financial officer, Desiree Kennedy, explained what this could look like for the city before council.
The community bonds, so they are a type of social bond, and they are used generally to, the focus of them is generally to have a return that's more around social or environmental impact, so some sort of a positive social impact. They are a community bond in that they do focus on community engagement as opposed to, say, a municipality just going and issuing a bond and doing something. This is about the community being engaged and coming up with solutions, one of which would be a community bond. The other thing is that they tend to be smaller values so that public can participate and be part of what the solution is. They have been used, there's actually a couple of housing examples within Ontario where they've been used. They generally are issued by a not-for-profit or a charity organization, not always by a municipality, though I know the City of Toronto does issue social bonds for various things, but they tend to be more issued through a community. I'm not as familiar, and I think part of this research will be the process around it and how that works, what the interest rate might look like, and potentially it could be a little bit of a lower interest rate if investors are willing to give up some rate in terms of seeing that the impact happening from the bond.
Community bond utilization can be found throughout the province. Examples including Toronto's Social Debenture Program, Kensington Market Community Land Trust, and Haliburton County's Places for People. Kennedy also noted that the city will most likely not incur extra administrative costs.
I think that's part of the research that we will do. I don't see it. I think potentially it would be another entity that would be working to issue those bonds. There is actually a company in Toronto that helps to assist smaller entities with respect to issuing these types of bonds as well. And that's part of the research we will do, is to reach out and have a conversation with them. But certainly, sort of at first glance, without doing more research, I really don't see it as being something that would be a cost administrative to the city.
Councillor Connie Glenn, who sits on the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee, motivated the motion, a task that has been in the works for quite some time, according to Councillor Jeff McLaren.
I just want to bring attention to the fact that you were leading this community bond thing through the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee. It's something that we've been trying to do for almost two terms now, and you got it done. So thank you very much for your leadership on this.
Staff will provide the Housing and Homelessness Committee and Council with an information report by the third quarter of 2025 with best practices for social investment options. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the local journalism initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about the findings of a risk assessment analysis on the presence of alcohol in Napanee facilities.
Thank you, Jesse. At a recent meeting, the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee discussed the perks and pitfalls of hosting alcohol use in town-owned facilities. On May 7th, Council received a report entitled Risk Analysis Related to Alcohol Use on Town Property. The town's Chief Administrative Officer, Matthew Grant, provided Council with the report, which noted that the Town of Greater Napanee oversees several facilities, parks, and sports fields and must adhere to several provincial standards and laws to meet its legal obligations. Grant reported that Greater Napanee has had a municipal alcohol policy since 1999 when a committee developed it after receiving a request from Addictions and Mental Health Ontario. The policy has not been updated since 1999. Grant pointed out that if an incident or injury occurs on municipal property, the town takes on significantly more liability when it operates a bar and acts as a commercial host. Grant explained that liability-related impacts to the municipality and subsequent court awards related to serving alcohol can vary depending on the nature of an incident and the municipality's ability to demonstrate that it has taken all reasonable steps to meet its responsibilities as the license holder. Grant pointed out that the town is currently taking on more liability than is advisable by acting as a commercial host at its facilities. Neither the town's legal counsel nor the town's insurer believes it is advisable for Greater Napanee to hold a liquor license and serve liquor, as the town is, in many cases, taking on all liability for events that it does not plan, control, or staff beyond the provision of alcohol. Grant recommended the town cancel the liquor license and use special occasion permits instead. This would still permit alcohol consumption in municipal facilities, but would prevent the town from taking on liability for activities it does not control. Grant's recommendation was debated by members of the council. Ultimately, it was decided that the liquor license should be retained, but that changes should be made to the municipal alcohol policy. Changes will include directing staff as a matter of policy on what to do if they become aware of the unauthorized use of alcohol or drugs in town facilities. The revised policy will also offer guidance to the public about contacting the OPP about such violations during hours when town staff are not on duty. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LGI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the approval of a $23,000 physician recruitment incentive.
Thank you, Dinah. A doctor with global experience may soon be treating local patients in Lansdowne thanks to a unanimous council decision. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands Council unanimously approved a funding package of up to $23,200 to support an incoming locum physician at the St. Lawrence District Medical Center in Lansdowne. The move includes a policy exception to allow a housing allowance for the visiting doctor, who will temporarily reside in Brockville during her placement. The physician, a Canadian citizen currently practicing at a U.S.-run medical clinic in Africa, is interested in completing an experiential locum at the Lansdowne Clinic as part of the township's ongoing efforts to recruit a permanent family doctor. The locum is expected to begin mid-May, pending final approval of her credentials to practice in Ontario. Typically, under the township's Physician Experiential Locum Grant policy, a housing allowance of $2,000 per month for up to 2 months is only available if the physician resides within the township. Living outside TLTI, such as in Brockville, entitles physicians to a smaller travel allowance of $350 per week. However, recognizing the importance of securing medical talent, council approved a policy exception that allows the Brockville-based doctor to receive the higher housing allowance. The total approved funding includes the $4,000 housing allowance and up to $19,200 in salary support, representing 40% of the locum's negotiated per diem pay. The funds will come from the township's Special Projects Reserve Fund, which currently holds over $670,000. The additional cost of approving the housing allowance over the travel allowance amounts to $1,200. If the locum ends up being shorter than 2 months, less funding will be used. Council's decision reflects growing efforts to secure stable medical care in TLTI communities, especially as the SLDMC prepares for an upcoming physician retirement.
Thank you, Jesse. And now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the new $88 million water pollution plant in Napanee.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. A new water pollution control plant upgrade and replacement project in Napanee is underway. Greater Napanee Council approved a contract with Peak Construction for nearly $75.5 million. The overall project cost is nearly $88 million, with $34.8 million in funding coming from the province and another $14 million from the federal government. Between that funding and the town's reserves, it leaves $25 million to be funded through loans. Staff noted a total of $5.5 million in contingencies, with $4 million of it built into tender pricing as an allowance for tariffs. Mayor Terry Richardson spoke about the scale of the project.
I know folks out there are going to say, how is $25 million affordable? But an affordable way of getting this municipality into the future. I've said it many times that, this is the largest investment we've made in this municipality in 170 years. And there are a lot of other municipalities I think would be wishing they were in the position that we are right now.
Richardson noted the importance of the funding they received.
Yes, $25 million is a lot of money to take a loan out on, but it is our future. We couldn't do it without the help of our partners, of our federal partners, and maybe more importantly, our provincial partners, who I couldn't imagine having this conversation if we didn't have the funding that we received to get us where we need to, because if $25 million scares you, $60 million should scare the bejumpins out of you.
General Manager of Growth and Infrastructure and Chief Building Official Michael Nobes explained why the project is needed.
We need this for the anticipated growth of the community. So we are anticipating a significant amount of both residential, commercial, and industrial growth within the urban settlement area, as well as modest growth within the rural area. So we are anticipating additional rural growth that would have the need for sewage disposal through septic tank disposal. So that is being planned for in the design and throughout the construction of the project.
Richardson noted how important the future of the town is, referencing all the work done in the past.
There can't be a Band-Aid left in this country because they put them all on this wastewater treatment plan to get us to where we are today. And there just isn't any left. It's worn out. It needs to be replaced. And again, it is our future. This is the future of our municipality right here. And I know it sounds really kind of strange and weird that we should be excited about a wastewater treatment plant, but we really should, because it's going to give us the future that we deserve in this municipality.
Nobes detailed the timeline for completion.
Through 2027, we would see the project continue, and midway through 2027 or towards the end of 2027 is when the commissioning of the plant would be undertaken, and through 2027, 2028 and onward, bringing the new facility up to full operation is the anticipated timeline.
Nobes spoke about the overall goals of the project and the expected location.
Replace aging infrastructure with new enhanced treatment to dramatically reduce partially treated wastewater during bypass events as a result of heavy flows entering the plant, and to provide further growth opportunities for the community through new development. The new plant would be located immediately west of the existing site and consists of new headworks, new activated granular sludge tanks, tertiary treatment UV disinfection, and an operations and control building. Ultimately, we're looking to increase the hydraulic capacity of the plant, eliminate bypassing during peak wet weather events, and to comply with the Bay Oconee Remedial Action Plan to reduce, provide for a better effluent leaving the plant.
Staff will also be working on modernizing processes to simplify operations, improve energy efficiency, and decrease life cycle costs. The report noted the existing plant location will become available for future expansion projects when required. Nobes detailed the type of growth the new plant could support.
This new plant would provide for the capacity up to an anticipated and approximate 4,000 new homes, in addition to a mix of commercial and industrial growth. And as we see this new development proceed, the assessment growth of the municipality will ultimately grow, which helps to provide additional operating and capital revenues for the municipality for future planning. We have nearly 1,600 dwelling units approved that are either in the construction stage or are considered shovel ready. So draft plan approved, site plan approved, final plan of subdivision approved. And these units were highlighted in our funding application to the province, which helped get us the amount of funding that we ultimately did from the province. Of the 1600 units that are approved per se, we would be looking at 16 years of build out for those.
Only pre-qualified general contractors were able to view the tender and submit a bid. For a compliant submission, the report stated all pre-qualified general contractors had to partner with pre-qualified electrical and mechanical contractors. Director of Environmental Services Christy Kelly explained the bids they received and noted who Peak Construction will be working with.
4 out of 5 of the GCs submitted bids, and all 4 were compliant. In addition to the general contractor work, Peak will utilize internal resources for the mechanical work and will be working with Sheridan Electric as their electrical contractor.
Kelly spoke about contingencies built in and noted U.S. tariffs as a main cause.
There's $4 million here that is set aside for tariffs. We all know there's some uncertainties with the way things are right now, and a lot of that pre-selected equipment is being purchased from the United States. So we've allowed that contingency allowance in there for such a thing.
Nobes explained staff's intentions with the contingencies.
The intent is not to use these contingencies at all, but we did want to set out a plan for council's awareness and for the community that really was as conservative as possible to take into account potential unknowns at this point.
Kelly explains why they couldn't choose Canadian options or options from other countries besides the United States.
The pre-selected equipment, including the AGS tanks specifically and or the activated granular sludge process is a United States-based process. So that was purchased, again, before the talks of these tariffs. We had to pre-select these pieces of equipment. We've certainly are working to do our best to ensure that, as I'm sure much of our country is, to purchase locally as much as possible, but a lot of these items were unfortunately only available from the United States.
Nobe speaks about the expected lifetime for the new plant, touching on upgrades in the distant future, and mentioning the history of the current plant as well.
The existing plant, it was built in 1953. It's still in operation today. The actual use of it, 50 plus years, is anticipated. Routine maintenance will always be required. But we would be talking a 50 plus year design of the building. When the capacity of the plant is reached, per se, ultimately would depend on the rate at which the municipality builds out over time. So it would ultimately depend on how quickly the building permits are being pulled and homes are ultimately being built. If it's, I'd say it's worth looking back over the last few years, we're looking at in the range of 100-ish units per year, ballpark.
Nobes talks about the potential of future upgrades.
It is very straightforward to add additional cells. Adding additional cells onto the site is not going to be a challenge. It would be a matter of doing additions to the existing footprint. So it's not like we would be looking at all a brand new $80 million project again in the future. It would be a much more modest amount to add additional capacity, more or less additions onto those portions of the structure, as a lot of the headworks, the UV treatment and other buildings on the site would be able to function with these additions onto those cells.
Nobes speaks about the $34.8 million they received from the provincial government and explains the $14 million they got in 2020 from the federal government.
That was through the Canada Infrastructure Program for Ontario's allocation to the rural and northern communities infrastructure stream. We were successful with working with our local MP on getting our name pulled up the list to get that funding. And last year, we were successful in receiving provincial funding, just under $35 million. And with that, it is certainly making the project feasible. Without these contributions, we would not be in a financial state to be able to undertake this significant infrastructure project fully on our own.
Nobes highlighted staff's appearances at ROMA conferences as a reason they received the funding.
I recall being with council at ROMA delegations and discussions with ministers prior to submitting those applications, and I think those really helped to bring our application up in the queue in the eyes of the province. And I think it really helped get us to this point and have a good outcome with those funding applications.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about an OPP cadet program in Prince Edward County.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
The Ontario Provincial Police have resurrected the cadet program, something that has gone by the wayside for years. The Picton Detachment in Prince Edward County has their first recruit, Katrina Royer, who has completed her first year at the Police Foundation's program at Loyalist College in Belleville. Katrina has been interested in policing from a young age, and the cadet program gives her the opportunity to experience policing firsthand, learn, and determine if law enforcement will be her chosen career path. Cadet Katrina Royer and Officer Nikki Cordingly tell us more.
Good morning. My name is Katrina Royer, and I'm a cadet with Prince Edward County OPP.
My name is Constable Nikki Cordingly. I am the Community Engagement Officer and Media Relations Officer with Prince Edward County OPP.
Is this the first time that there's been a cadet in this detachment?
I believe so, yes. The goal is kind of to have one per detachment at least, so It's, you know, a constant moving program. It's only a one-year program, can be a two-year, so, you know, as cadets hopefully get hired on, they phase other people through to kind of get that experience.
So tell me, how did you become interested in all of this?
So I've been interested in policing for a long time, actually. I have some family in the OPP. So before I was working as a detachment admin clerk, so that's the person at the front desk, answer the phones, and help people at the front. So that was in Northumberland. Then I actually decided I wanted to go back to school. So I'm at Loyalist College doing the Police Foundation's program. But the problem was I actually couldn't do the admin clerk position while I was still in school. But the cadet program actually gives you the opportunity to work part-time during the school year, and then once it's summer, goes back up to full-time. So that was kind of how I decided to do the cadet program. It's, like I said, it's a one-year program, can be 2 years, so it's perfect for while you're in school.
So how did you find out about this?
So I found out about it actually just on the OPP.ca website. They always have their postings on different careers and all of that, and I just looked one day and I saw the cadet program. I was interested. I talked to few of my colleagues at the time, and they were kind of saying, yeah, it's a kind of new kind of project that they brought back from a long time ago. So yeah, I was super excited and put in my application.
How long is the police program at Loyalist?
So that's a two-year program.
Mm-hmm. And you're where with that?
So I've completed my first year. I'm just on my summer break right now. Then I have one more year to go. So halfway done. Yeah.
And then I guess you could apply to OPP, or will you automatically get into OPP, or how does that work? Apply to it?
So yeah, I do have to reapply, but what's nice about the cadet program is a lot of the applications that I've had to do is actually quite similar to the constable applications. So I've had just a lot of experience, not even just working as a cadet, but also the whole application process. It's really given me, you know, a good idea of what I'm going to be seeing in the future as well.
So what does a cadet do?
So we have a bunch of different roles. It's not really specifically laid out. It's mostly what your detachment commander would like you to do. So me personally, I help at the front desk. I answer phones. I also help with fingerprints. So I do both civil and criminal fingerprints. And probably my favorite thing that I get to do is go out on patrol with officers. So whenever they get to go to calls, I can just join along, see how they handle it, get that experience. I'm actually allowed to drive cruisers as well, so if we need to drop them off at shops, then that's pretty nice. Another thing is I do have access to our police system, so I can take very minor calls. So, for example, if someone, you know, found a lost credit card or something, they bring it to the detachment. Instead of taking that time away from officers, I can actually just take that report myself and complete that.
Wow. Yeah, so. Drive a cruiser.
Yeah, a lot of different things.
Wow, yeah. Katrina.
She does a lot of stats for us as well. Yeah. I feel like we're constantly emailing her for stats on impaireds and intimate partner violence. So, yeah, she's amazing.
What other interests do you have?
What other interests? I like doing kickboxing.
Really?
Yeah. I've done kickboxing for quite a few years. It was actually my one friend that introduced me to it. I've been doing it for about 4 years, I think. And just this year, I started doing a little bit of jiu-jitsu as well. So that's kind of another thing I do on the side. Love doing that. It's great. Really like just reading and stuff. Stuff like that.
Well, those activities are going to come in handy. Oh, yeah, I wish as an OPP officer in the future. So now, when you're finished here as the cadet and you're finished your college program and apply, you still have to do the police training at Aylmer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Everybody has to do that.
Yeah.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to tell me and get some information out?
I think I would just say, like, the cadet program, I think, is fantastic. Like, I look at someone like Katrina and she's getting all of this experience prior to applying to the OPP. And I think, you know, it can give individuals a chance to get into the program and say, okay, is this something I really want to do? Having the experience here and getting to do some things. And then that will help them decide. But also, I think it sets her up for success when she makes that application and is going to be successful. So
I'll just highly recommend the cadet program. I think it's given me just a lot of experience to be able to learn more and hopefully help me in my application in the future.
Just by looking at you, you love it. You love this cadet program, and both of you work together very well. I can see that. Really wonderful. Well, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Next up is Jessie Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the City of Kingston. Thursday, May 15th, warmest day of the week thus far, daytime high of 22 degrees with that same 40% chance of precipitation, dropping down to 12 overnight. Friday, May 16th, heading into the Victoria Day long weekend, daytime high of 23, but we will see rainy conditions throughout the day, a 60% chance of rain, dropping down to 12 overnight. Saturday, May 17th, another beautiful day, mix of sun and cloud with a 60% chance of precipitation, a little bit cooler at 20 degrees. Sunday, May 18th, cloudy, cooling down a little bit after a couple days of rain, daytime high of 15. Monday, May 19th, daytime high of 15 as well with cloudy conditions. And then Tuesday, May 20th, we're going to see a high of 18, 30% chance of rain, and an overnight low of 9 degrees.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.